worst of it. A spacer's bride would have a better life than someone trapped in the zones. Women were treated with respect in space. The woman looked back at him, her eyes cold and dispassionate. "Welcome on board," she said. "I'm Captain Harrison, Abigail Harrison. I'll show you to your quarters so you can drop off your bags. Then I'll give you a tour of the ship, or what parts of it you can access at the moment, anyway."
"That would be very interesting," Alan said.
He winced inwardly. It was clear that Captain Harrison knew something about them. What had she been told? If she knew that Alan had been in Colchester, what did she think he'd done?
"Thank you for your time."
Abigail eyed him for a long moment. "Follow me," she grunted. "And don't stick your hand into any of the open panels." Alan looked around with interest as they walked up the corridor. Abigail hadn't been joking about the open panels. A dozen wall and ceiling panels had been removed, exposing the ship's power distribution network. Alan frowned as he realized that half the visible components were no longer original, perhaps not even from British factories. Belters were supposed to be good at getting Russian and Chinese components to mesh with their British counterparts, but he couldn't help being concerned. The original components had been significantly over-engineered. He had no way to know if their replacements lived up to the same standards.
"We'd better hope," he told himself, "and check everything twice. Better to have a blowout here than in deep space."
The corridors were decorated with all kinds of paintings and pictures, some clearly drawn by children, while others owed their existence to more talented artists. Alan felt a stab of envy, mingled with grim amusement and regret. Haddock was a home as much as she was a ship, a home that was being turned into a fortress. His training told him he should order the decorations taken down. Common sense insisted he should keep his mouth shut. The civilian crew wouldn't be happy if they were told to embrace military culture. If they'd wanted to follow orders without question, they would have joined the military. They stopped outside a pair of hatches. "You and Lieutenant Bennett will be sharing this compartment," Abigail informed them as the closest hatch hissed open. "Lieutenant Hudson has this cabin to herself, for the moment. She'll be paired up with another woman when we have a suitable candidate."
"Thank you," Maddie said quietly.
Abigail nodded, then indicated the open hatch.
"Two bunks, a wardrobe, and a private washroom. Water is limited at the moment, so showers are restricted to 5 minutes each. Hopefully we'll get the recyclers back online in the next few days, and then we can take longer showers. There's a small terminal in the bulkhead, but I suggest you use your datapad for anything private. I can't guarantee computer security."
Bennett cleared his throat.
"I presume we're still in lockdown?"
"More or less," Abigail said. "Any messages you send will be routed through the asteroid signal buffer, so don't write anything you don't want the sensors to see. We're too far from any other settlement for real-time communications, for better or worse. I haven't been told what will happen if you do try to break the information embargo, but I don't think it will be pleasant."
She stepped inside and opened the wardrobe.
"I want all three of you in ship suits at all times," she added.
Her voice turned faintly sarcastic.
"Wear your overalls over them, if you wish, but make sure your masks are easily accessible. You can't breathe outside the hull, as I'm sure you're aware. We don't want to suddenly have a hull breach, but the way they're buzzing around outside..." "I thought the hull was armored," Maddie said. "Technically, it is," Abigail said. "But if there's an accident with a cutting torch..." "Well..."
She shrugged.
"The engineers swear blind that we'll be ready for departure in 8 days," she said.
Her lips quirked, as if she was making a joke.
"It was 10 days, 2 days ago. I suggest you spend the time familiarizing yourselves with the ship, but stay out of their way. I don't want any accidents. My insurance won't stand it."
"Understood, Captain," Alan said.
Perhaps it would be better to stay in the cabin. A datapad full of e-books or videos
would be better company than Bennett, and having a datapad would make up for the cramped compartment. There was no way Bennett and himself could dress simultaneously.
Is there anything else we ought to know?
Two things, Abigail said. She stepped back outside the cabin, meeting his eyes. First, most of my crew are civilian volunteers. They might be being paid hazard rates, but they're not naval personnel in anything, even in name. Do not treat them as slaves. You'll find they're good at their jobs, but they're not so good at discipline.
I have never treated anyone like a slave, Alan said.
Goody, Abigail said. Second, then. The files weren't too clear on what you actually did to earn yourselves a jail sentence. I have been assured that none of you pose a serious risk to my crew, but I've been given no way to judge that for myself. I have not shared what little I know about your pasts with my crew, just to ensure they don't allow it to affect their work. And frankly, I'm not sure that was wise.
She kept her eyes firmly fixed on his.
I will not tolerate anything that smacks of criminal behavior, she warned him. From any of you, starfighter pilots as well as support crews. And if I get a single hint that you're going back to your old ways, you will be pitched out of the airlock. Do I make myself clear?
Yes,
Alan said flatly.
It was hard, so hard, not to shake his head in disbelief. He was meant to work with this woman.
He didn't really blame Abigail for being concerned, not when she didn't know what he'd actually done, but it would sour their relationship completely. Perhaps he should tell her the truth. Or Maddie should tell Abigail about her crimes. The Rockrats would enjoy the story of an overpromoted aristocratic pig being taken for a ride by someone he'd considered nothing more than arm candy. They might even side with Maddie when they found out the truth. Get into your ship suits, Abigail ordered. I'll be back in 20 minutes.
A woman after my own heart,
Bennett said, once they were inside the tiny cabin.
I like her.
Alan snorted.
She thinks you're a criminal too.
Bennett laughed.
I have ID I can show her, if necessary, he said. You do realize she's married?
No,
Alan said.
Four husbands, five wives, Bennett said. Group marriages are not uncommon in the Belt, as you know. Four of them stay in their warren, looking after the younger children, while the remaining adults go out to bring home the bacon. The older children are already moving into adulthood. Captain Harrison has two children, both serving on this ship.
Alan shrugged as he stripped off his tunic and reached for the ship suit. It was a naval design, as ugly and uncomfortable as he remembered. Wearing it was like wearing a second skin, but he knew he'd be glad of it if there was a hull breach. It wouldn't provide quite as much protection as a normal spacesuit. It might just make the difference between life or death.
As long as you're close to a shelter or emergency supplies, he thought,
remembering his instructor's warnings. The man had put the cadets through hell, but they'd known it was necessary.
If you're too far from either, take advantage of the last few seconds to bend over and kiss your ass goodbye. Tiny shower too, Bennett said. No room to bend over if you drop the soap. How fortunate,
Alan said crossly. He was getting tired of Bennett constantly poking and prodding to see what would draw a reaction.
And these beds were obviously not designed for your enormous bulk.
Bennett leered cheerfully.
I suppose I might just break the upper bunk and land on your head, he said. That would solve one problem rather nicely, wouldn't it? Get bent,
Alan said. He refused to consider the possibility. Military bunks might be small, but they were designed to take far heavier weights. Weren't they? This was a civilian ship. He pushed the thought aside before it could depress him too much.
I'll be outside. Don't go wandering off, Bennett told him. The captain will not be pleased.
Alan nodded and stepped through the hatch. Maddie was waiting for him, wearing her overalls over the ship suit. It did nothing this time to hide the shape of her body.
Alan looked away, cursing himself. He'd just have to keep himself under control.
You can always take matters in hand later, he told himself. You should be used to being watched by now.
Chapter 7.
Abigail hadn't been sure what to expect from the convicted criminals. The Belt shunned minor criminals to the point where they either took their own lives or shipped out somewhere no one had ever heard their name, while major criminals were simply executed and their bodies fed into the recycler. It was rare for a Belter criminal to ever earn forgiveness for his crimes, if only because anything the Belt considered a crime was serious. It had to involve someone getting hurt, or a very good chance of someone getting hurt. She allowed her gaze to flicker across them as they waited. The red-headed woman looked innocent, but Abigail had been a daughter and then a mother. She wasn't fooled by an act designed to make people overlook the actress. Men could be such fools at times. A woman who looked weak and helpless would spark either protective or predatory instincts, rather than warning the men to watch their backs. An entire ring of thugs had been busted a year or two ago on Ceres for using young women as Judas goats. They'd picked up wealthy men and lured them into their apartments, where they'd been robbed and drugged by the male thieves. The redhead might not be physically dangerous, but that meant nothing. Abigail would keep an eye on her anyway. The two men were odder. Lieutenant Bennett was rough and crude. Abigail had no trouble recognizing a very dangerous man. But there was something about him that made her feel safe. That puzzled her more than she cared to admit. She'd had worse vibes, far worse vibes, from men who hadn't looked anything like as dangerous. But then the Belt rarely had time for politeness. It was considered better to say what you meant and deal with the consequences, rather than hide behind half-truths and passive-aggressive verbal conflict. And Commander Campbell was odder. Clearly an educated man, but weighed down by guilt. Guilt for what exactly? Abigail cursed again, whoever it was who'd refused to forward the uncensored files to Tallyman. She needed to know what he'd done. There was something about Campbell. She supposed she'd better get used to thinking of him as Alan, if he was to be her XO, that bothered her. He didn't have the same presence as Bennett, yet there was a sense of violence below the surface. What the hell had he done? Better find a way to ask him, she told herself, and hope to hell he tells the truth. As you can see, the entire upper section has been converted into a maze of living quarters, control centers, and a couple of training suites, she said, as she led them through the corridors. They weren't seeing the ship at her best, but it couldn't be helped. There are two sections set aside for the pilots, with 12 bunks in each one. I assume that will be suitable?
It won't be any worse than the quarters on a fleet carrier, Alan said.
His voice held a faint accent that reminded Abigail of one of her distant relatives.
Do you have an exercise compartment?
And a gaming room, Abigail said. One of my kids is very fond of Sonic the Hedgehog. He downloaded copies of everything from the classical versions to the 5th or 6th VR reboot. You're welcome to play the games, if you have time.
Maybe after I've brushed up on Starfighter flying, Alan said.
He sounded oddly amused by her words.
Is there enough space for the support crews?
Aye,
Abigail said. They stopped outside one of the sleeping quarters. Abigail opened the hatch, allowing them to look inside.
We're sleeping 6 to a compartment here. Again, it's not ideal, but it's the best we can do.
I've been in worse places,
Alan said.
Try sleeping in a foxhole sometime, sir,
Bennett told him.
It's uncomfortable as fuck.
Abigail glanced at him, puzzled. Lieutenant Bennett was outranked by Commander Campbell, but Bennett didn't act like a naval officer. His file had been curiously sparse, too sparse. She wondered suddenly if he'd been in the army instead. Or maybe he'd been in a deniable unit,
and very little had actually been committed to the data files. There was no way to know, short of trying to talk him into revealing his past. And she had a feeling that Bennett, for all of his crudeness, actually kept himself under very tight control. "There are two showers at the rear of each compartment," Abigail said, dismissing the mystery. She could think about it later. "By the time the crew arrive, the water restrictions should have been lifted. If not," she shrugged, "they'll just have to get used to it." She led them out the hatch and down the corridor. "There's no such thing as a secondary bridge on a freighter, so we put the CIC in here," she explained, as she opened another hatch. "It's very makeshift, but it should do."
"I hope so," Alan said.
Abigail tried to see it through his eyes. A pair of consoles and chairs, a holographic projector. She'd seen footage of life on board a fleet carrier. Their combat information centers were immense, with enough space for a couple of dozen staffers. Haddock barely had room for two or three people, unless they were very good friends. She glanced at Maddie, trailing behind the men. Was she close to either of them? Or was this their first meeting? It was impossible to be sure. "We built as much redundancy as we could into the network," she told them. "But this ship is still very fragile. A direct hit will be enough to put us out of the battle."
"Blow us into atoms, you mean?" Alan said.
He sat down in one of the chairs and looked around.
"Have you tested the systems?"
"We did the basics," Abigail said. "But actual drills and live fire exercises? No."
"Something to do then, as soon as we're ready," Alan said. "The sooner we figure out the problems, the sooner we can fix them."
"Yes, sir," Maddie said. Abigail kept her thoughts to herself as they walked through the rest of the upper decks, pausing briefly to introduce the newcomers to her crew. Sickbay was a joke compared to a military facility. There was no trained doctor, merely an auto doc. Abigail and several of her crew had some medical training, but not enough to cope with more than a handful of basic injuries. The life support units were over-engineered, yet they were still going to be pushed to the limit. And engineering was in complete disarray.
"We think we've worked out most of the kinks," she said, as they headed back to the CIC. "But we have no way to be sure."
"We'll find out when we go to work," Alan assured her. "How many spare parts are we carrying?"
"Not as many as I'd like," Abigail admitted. "We're on the list for whatever's available, but..."
She gritted her teeth in frustration. On one hand, the Royal Navy had given her a blank check. On the other, there just weren't enough supplies to go around. The peacetime Navy simply hadn't built up the stockpiles if they would need to fight a major war. She hoped some balmy bureaucrat was going to be penalized for that particular balls-up. It would take time, perhaps too much time, to kickstart production to meet wartime requirements. Until then, the Royal Navy was going to be facing all kinds of shortfalls.
"Maybe we can requisition a couple of extra starfighters," Alan said. "We could turn them into hangar queens, if necessary."
"And you could fly one yourself, sir," Bennett offered. "We might need you out there."
"I haven't flown a starfighter for years," Alan pointed out. "I'm not even sure what model starfighters we'll be getting."
"Better to be out there shooting back," Bennett said. "Maddie can handle starfighter operations if necessary."
Abigail cleared her throat.
"I trust you to handle such matters yourself," she said, as they walked into the cramped CIC. "You have authorization to use the shipboard datanet, but be careful. Make sure you clear anything you want to upload with the engineers first."
Bennett gave her an odd look.
"Is the system that fragile, Captain?"
"Right now, yeah," Abigail said. "They tore out one of our two data cores and replaced it with an updated version, then spent a day rewriting the programming to convince the newer data core to talk to the older data core. I've been assured that the command and control system remains intact and isolated, but I'm not actually sure. Given time, the AIs will bridge the gap permanently."
She sighed. AI had never quite lived up to its promise, unless one believed that the AIs actually were intelligent and chose to hide it. Talking to an AI was like talking to a child who never actually learned from experience, let alone grew up. Learning systems never seemed to make the jump into genuine intelligence. The military was reluctant to allow AIs anywhere near its vessels, pointing out the dangers involved. She was tempted, for once, to think that the military might have a point.
"Again, we'll work on it," Alan said.
He looked down at the darkened console.
"If you don't mind, we'll start at once."
Abigail's lips twitched. She couldn't complain about his work ethic, she supposed, even though he'd only arrived a couple of hours ago. But she would have urged them to have a nap, if she'd thought they'd take the advice. She had no idea if they'd slept on the shuttle or not, but it couldn't have been very comfortable. "It is 1500 hours now," she said, glancing at her wristcom. "I request the pleasure of your company at 1900 hours for dinner." She watched them closely. Bennett showed no visible reaction, but both Alan and Maddie looked uncomfortable. What did that mean? No one on the ship, apart from her, knew they'd been in jail. Were they reluctant to meet the rest of the crew, or were they feeling a little overwhelmed? Abigail could move between crowded asteroids and empty ships without a qualm, but she had a feeling jail would be a little different.
"It will be our pleasure," Alan said finally. "We thank you."
Abigail nodded, then spun on her heel and walked out the hatch. It hissed closed behind her, cutting off the sound. She would have liked to listen to whatever was said after she left, but she knew it was impossible. Instead, she checked her RISCOM's inbox as she headed down the corridor. Their client was somewhat bemused by how the cargo pallets had arrived at Ceres, but he was relieved to receive them anyway. "It won't be long before the truth gets out," Abigail thought. The news corporations might be closely supervised on Earth, but it was a great deal harder to keep spacers from talking to one another and sharing notes. And there was no shortage of hackers ready to spread news and rumors through the datanet. And then, who knows what will happen? She stopped outside the shuttle hatch and keyed the switch. It opened, revealing the interior of a military-grade shuttlecraft. Abigail guessed that whoever had designed the craft had either been a Royal Marine or a Belter, as the design was ruthlessly practical instead of comfortable. Anson was seated in the cockpit, his fingers dancing over the keyboard. He seemed to be having fun. Abigail cleared her throat. "What do you make of it?" Anson looked up and smiled. "Awesome," he said. "This baby is light years ahead of our old piece of junk. It isn't as if we ever had to make Planetfall," Abigail pointed out dryly. Trying to land Haddock on a planetary surface would be an expensive form of suicide. "How many times did we actually use the shuttle?" "Twice, at Wayland," Anson reminded her. "But those were meant to be once-offs." He tapped the control stick. "I can put this baby down in a storm," he said. The confidence in his voice sounded unshakable. "And then land her on a dime." "Be very careful," Abigail warned. "You've never flown through a real storm, have you?" Anson nodded, but he looked unabashed. Abigail sighed inwardly. She'd handle a couple of rough landings, but otherwise she'd stayed in space when she hadn't let someone else do the flying. It was hard for a Belter to understand just how rough a planetary atmosphere could be if one didn't take very good care. She honestly couldn't understand why immigration to outer space wasn't much higher. Unlimited space, unlimited resources, unlimited wealth, and no weather. Why would anyone choose to live on a planetary surface when they could live in space? "I've been downloading training simulations," Anson said after a moment. "The shuttle isn't that different from the standard designs. I should be able to fly it without problems. And we have everything from military-grade emergency beacons to military-grade emergency kits. They even gave us some suspension drugs." "Very good," Abigail said. She walked into the cockpit. There was no bulkhead between the cockpit and the passenger compartment, something that puzzled her. and sat in the co-pilot's seat.
What else do you have to tell me?
I got a data packet from George, Anson said. Apparently, rumours are getting out. And a number of people have noticed that we never arrived on Ceres, but our cargo did. We're not the only ones, it seems. There's some quite accurate speculation running around the datanet.
His face darkened.
And Cindy has apparently started dating Peppy. I'm sorry to hear that, Abigail said.
She was torn between relief and profound sympathy for her son. Cindy was strikingly pretty, but Abigail had never considered her suitable marriage material. Too self-centered, at least by Belter standards, and probably not inclined to join a group marriage where everyone either worked to support the family or took care of the children.
There are plenty more fish in the sea.
You were married at 20, Anson pointed out. Dad was, what, 25? Boys do tend to get married a little later than girls, Abigail pointed out.
She allowed herself a smile.
I did have to have children, you know.
I don't want to know,
Anson said quickly. Abigail laughed, then sobered. It wasn't uncommon for children, even grown children, to deny the idea that their parents might have been sexual beings. Abigail knew her parents must have had sex at least 5 times. She had 4 siblings, but she didn't want to think about it. No doubt her parents had reproduced by using an exo-womb, although they would still have had to get the eggs and sperm from somewhere. She dismissed the thought in amused irritation.
Cindy's just playing the field before she settles down and gets married, she said.
Personally, she doubted Cindy would ever settle down, but there was no way to be sure. God knew Abigail had done some pretty silly things in her day.
When you get back from our next cruise, you'll be a war hero. They won't be able to say I was a coward, Anson agreed. But serving on an escort carrier isn't really that heroic.
That's what the Japanese believed, back in the Second World War, Abigail said.
The briefing notes had been very detailed when it came to historical examples.
They didn't put any real effort into protecting their freighters when they sailed to and from the Japanese home islands. And so the American submarines sank pretty much all of the freighters.
She shrugged.
Meanwhile, the British and Americans protected their freighters. Ships ran in convoys, escorted by warships. And so the shipping got through, and the good guys won the war. Except in Eastern Europe, she added silently.
She looked up some of the context, too, just to try and determine if she was being snowballed.
One set of very bad guys was defeated by another set of slightly less bad guys.
She snorted at the thought. The Second World War was over 200 years in the past, a simpler time in many ways. She had very little in common with the women of that era, although she imagined she had a great deal in common with the freighter captains. And yet it had laid the seeds for the next set of global conflicts, as well as the technology that had allowed humanity to finally escape its homeworld.
I'm glad to hear we're doing something useful, Anson said.
He didn't sound particularly convinced.
But it's hardly heroic. It's still a vital contribution, Abigail said.
She would have expected the Belters to understand, even if the ground pounders did not.
Could they keep those fleet carriers flying if they didn't get regular deliveries of supplies from home? Or new crewmen and pilots for those immense ships? Or... They need freighters, Anson. We're as much a part of the war effort as any warship.
She leaned forward, resting a hand on his arm.
Look, here's a suggestion. Spend some time in the starfighter training simulators. They won't be in use 24/7, so you should be able to find a time when you can have a go. See if you can pick up enough to request a transfer to the starfighter training center. And if you can, you can put in the request when we return to Sol.
Anson looked doubtful.
Would they take me? You're an experienced spacer, Abigail pointed out.
Her children knew how to think and operate in 3 dimensions. How many ground pounders could say the same?
You have much less to unlearn.
She rose.
But wait until we get back from our first voyage, she added. You don't want to give the Navy the impression you want to desert.
No, Anson agreed. That would be awkward.
Chapter 8.
You know, Alan muttered to Bennett, the Royal Navy has set new records for efficiency. The prospect of hanging does tend to concentrate a few minds, sir, Bennett agreed, as the starfighter pilots filed into the briefing room. Unfortunately, as a very great man put it, the prospect of hanging tends to concentrate the mind on the fact that it is about to be hanged.
Alan shot him a sidelong look.
You read making money.
Going postal,
Bennett corrected.
And yes, I read it.
Alan shook his head in wry amusement, then turned his attention back to the compartment.
It was a ramshackle affair, one that would have shocked any fleet carrier commander. 30 chairs, a single table, a simple projector. It was a far cry from the high-tech surroundings he'd been used to on Formidable. But it would have to do. He leaned against the bulkhead and watched grimly as the starfighter pilots filed into the compartment. 24 men and women, 18 to 24, wearing basic blues. Perhaps it was his imagination, but there was a sloppiness about them that galled him. He had never been so sloppy when he had been a starfighter pilot.
But you did your own share of stupid things,
his thoughts reminded him.
You're not in a position to bitch and moan about pilots who merely got drunk in the wardroom and rendered themselves unfit for duty.
He pushed the thought away as his eyes swept the room. A handful of names and faces were familiar to him from the files. Wing Commander Mike Whitehead and Wing Commander Mark Savage in particular. But others were complete unknowns. They'd all have disciplinary records, though. Drunkenness, fighting in bars. In one case, even being caught in bed with a senior officer. She was damn lucky not to have been immediately discharged, according to the files. Her paramour had been tossed into the brig and unceremoniously booted out of the Navy when their starship had returned home.
And now he'll probably be summoned back to the colours, Alan thought sadly, along with everyone else who didn't go too far.
The room settled down quickly. Alan allowed his eyes to wander over the small crowd, wondering which of them would cause trouble. There was usually one troublemaker per squadron. Hell, he had been the troublemaker as a younger man. The pilot who wore a uniform that looked two sizes too big for him. Or the pilot who wore a uniform that was too tight around her chest to pass muster on a regular carrier. Or the one who'd been caught in a drug den when he'd gone on leave. It wasn't illegal for a civilian, but it was a court-martial offence for a military officer. Alan made a mental note to keep an eye on him. Abigail might swear blind that her crewmen were clean, but in Alan's experience, there was always some smuggling going on. And someone would have set up an illicit still by now. Alan cleared his throat.
Welcome on board, he said shortly. I am Commander Alan Campbell, the senior military officer on Archibald Haddock.
He paused. Did they know him? It was possible they'd heard the story. He'd been told it had been extensively reported in the national news 5 years ago. But then some of the pilots would have been in secondary school at the time. They probably didn't remember his name.
All I'd have to do is look me up on the datanet, he thought sadly.
He had no idea how many people were called Alan Campbell, but it was unlikely that many of them had served in the Royal Navy.
And who knows what they'd think if they knew the truth. I won't waste your time with pleasant speeches, he added. You were assigned to this vessel because you're screw-ups. You have disciplinary records longer than my arm.
Longer than my dick,
Flight Lieutenant Sean Green catcalled.
It's big.
How lucky for you, Alan said, as pleasantly as he could. And if you interrupt me again, I'll cut it off.
A low ripple of amusement ran around the compartment. Alan ignored it.
I don't think any of you would have gotten through your review hearing if you lasted long enough to face one, he told them. And you know what? I don't care. You've all heard the news. We are at war, and standards have been lowered sharply to ensure that the Navy's manpower requirements are met. If you do well on Haddock, your records will be scrubbed clean. Fuck up, and there's a very good chance you won't live long enough to be dishonorably discharged. I don't care what you did before you reported to me. I don't care about the warnings your former commanders wrote into your files. I don't give a damn what you did when you went on leave. All I care about is getting the ship up and out into the fight. Do well, and we'll get along fine. Do poorly, and you'll find me the worst nightmare you'll ever have to face. There won't be a second warning.
He paused, giving his words a moment to sink in. The Royal Navy had always tolerated a certain degree of immature behavior from its starfighter pilots, knowing that the odds of any of them surviving a combat mission were terrifyingly low. Alan looked back on his past record and cringed inwardly. He couldn't blame his pilots for their stupidity when he had been just as stupid himself. And yet an escort carrier simply didn't have the space to tolerate foolishness. He was damned if he was putting up with it.
"This is war," he said. "We're going to be spending much of our time drilling. When you're not drilling, you'll be in your bunks. Don't expect any downtime for the next few weeks. By the time we actually see combat, I want us to be ready for it. There will be no alcohol, no drugs, no immersive VR sims. Nothing that could impair your performance. I don't have the manpower to tolerate any of you taking the day off because you have a hangover. Do not defy me on this, unless you want to be tossed out the nearest airlock. This is war. You will receive absolutely no sympathy whatsoever if you run to the nearest admiral and start bitching about not being able to drink. I'll be inspecting your quarters later. I suggest that you ship any bottles of rotgut you might have brought with you back home before I find them. They'll be poured into the shitter if I do."
He sighed inwardly. There would be a bottle or two, of course. Someone would have obtained a cheap bottle of shipboard rotgut, or splashed out half a month's wages on scotch or Vulcan ale. He wouldn't make any friends either when he confiscated the alcohol. But it couldn't be helped. He simply didn't have the manpower to cover up a hangover, even if he had wanted to. Hard questions would be asked about why one of his pilots wasn't flying.
"And someone will take a look at our statistics," he thought sourly.
The Admiralty had been demanding regular reports as the refit progressed, apparently so they could decide if they should start the next set of conversions.
"There's always some jumped-up bean counter, eager to prove he isn't a complete waste of space. Two other points to go over, then," he told them. "First, the captain and most of the crew are civilians, rather than military. Don't expect them to salute when they meet you, or to honor the finer points of military etiquette. That said, their ranks are to be treated as military ranks for the duration of the conflict, and you are to show them proper respect. The captain may not be a military officer, but she's been working in space longer than any of you have been alive. Do not dismiss them as useless."
He kept his face impassive. Some of the pilots would understand, he was sure, but others wouldn't. They'd absorbed a general contempt for civilians, for those who couldn't or wouldn't put their lives on the line during basic training. And he had no idea how many of them were mature enough to understand that a merchant spacer would have more experience than themselves. Starfighter pilots were used to thinking of themselves as the best. They wouldn't want to take orders from a civilian.
"Second, most of the crew has come from the asteroid belt, where things are different," he added. "They have a different culture, so don't assume that you can treat them like crewmen on a fleet carrier. This ship is too small for you to have a brief affair and then end it without repercussions. In particular, two of the crewmen are very young. Be careful who you try to lure into bed.
it would probably be better to stay celibate while you're on this ship.
Ouch! Green said.
Alan shrugged. It wasn't technically illegal for starfighter pilots to chase crewmen on fleet carriers, where the pilot and the crewman were in different chains of command. And no one under 18 would serve on a fleet carrier. It was a different story on a Belta ship. He had no idea how Abigail would react to a starfighter pilot trying to seduce her daughter, and he didn't want to find out. Starfighter pilots were alarmingly good at letting their dicks get them in trouble.
There will be shore leave at some point,
Alan assured them dryly. Sin City wasn't that far away.
And I'm sure some of you brought wank material with you.
He paused as a faint titter ran around the compartment.
I expect you all to act like adults, even if half of you are overgrown children. This is war. We don't have time to deal with minor problems. I expect complete professionalism when you're on duty, which will be most of the time. And I do not expect anything that happens off duty to affect your performance. If it does, I'll make damn sure you'll regret it. Wing commanders, remain behind. Everyone else, report to the starfighter launch tubes at 1400 hours. I'll be inspecting your quarters before then, so you should have just enough time to get rid of anything illicit before I see it. Any questions?
Green stuck up a hand.
What is the price of sliced ham, per portion?
Relevant questions,
Alan clarified. He supposed he should have seen that coming. The joke was older than interplanetary spaceflight.
No? Dismissed.
He watched as the pilots rose and headed through the hatch. Some of them were standing upright, walking like men who knew who and what they were. Others looked as if they could barely be bothered walking in a straight line. They wouldn't have long to shape up either, not when the ship was due to depart in 4 days. Ideally, Alan would have busted the worst of the troublemakers out of the squadrons, perhaps sending them to other starships so they'd have a chance to shape up. But that wasn't an option. The starfighter pilots he'd been sent had been on their last chance before the war began. None of them would have been allowed to remain in the Navy if the Navy hadn't been so desperate for trained manpower.
At least they weren't in jail,
he reminded himself dryly.
Take a seat,
he ordered the wing commanders. He glanced back at Bennett, then shrugged.
Do you have any concerns you want to raise?
Hundreds,
Wing Commander Mike Whitehead said.
I assume it would be pointless.
Alan had to smile sourly.
If you want to kick half of the pilots off the ship, then yes, he said.
Whitehead had a bit of a reputation as a worrywart, an odd trait in a squadron commander. He even looked like a weak-chinned milksop, the kind of person who'd never be allowed to serve on a recruiting poster. But then it had taken him time to climb the ladder. His stats simply weren't very good.
Do you have any others?
They're a fine group of men, Wing Commander Mark Savage said.
They might be rowdy, sir, but they'll do their damn jobs.
Glad to hear it,
Alan said. Savage was competent. That wasn't in doubt. But his disciplinary record was poor. He'd gone up and down the ranks as many times as a whore's knickers. If his stats hadn't been so good, he would probably have been discharged long ago.
That said, I wasn't kidding about no drink or drugs. Make sure your pilots understand it.
They're only human, Savage pointed out. A man who won't drink won't fight.
Alan looked back at him evenly. Savage had a certain rough charisma, the kind of man who'd be happy in a fight and sullenly resentful out of it. Maybe not the sort of guy the Navy would want to put on a recruitment poster either, but someone the Navy would find useful as long as his violent streak was pointed in the right direction. They tended to cause problems on shore leave because they were bored.
And the drunkard on deck risks the lives of his fellow crewmen, he said. I expect you to make it clear that there will be consequences for anything of the sort.
Better shut down the still, Whitehead said. Someone will be making rot gut, sir.
I know,
Alan said.
And when we catch them, they'll wish they'd never been born.
They're civilians, sir, Savage said. I don't think we can take them round the back and give them a beasting.
Alan shrugged. Abigail had assured him that her crewers wouldn't start brewing alcohol for themselves. That left the military personnel. He'd already read the support staff the Riot Act, but Whitehead was probably right. Someone would start fermenting alcohol for themselves pretty soon. It was an old tradition, one that senior officers normally chose to ignore, as long as it didn't impair performance. But Haddock's crew wasn't large enough to compensate for a crewman who'd managed to impair his performance.
We'll see, he said. Any other concerns?
I dare say some will manifest when we start drilling in earnest,
Whitehead said. Beside him, Savage nodded in agreement.
They know what they're doing, but they also have problems.
And there's a war on,
Savage said. He sounded oddly cheerful.
The prospect of getting out there, of getting stuck into the enemy, it'll put fire in their bellies.
Alan shrugged. There'd been disputes between America and China, and scrabbles over a handful of newly discovered systems and tram lines. But the great powers had worked hard to avoid a general war. The Royal Navy starfighter pilots hadn't seen action, real action, outside a handful of exercises and simulated drills. Now there actually was a war to fight. They'd soon find out just how effective their drills had actually been.
We shall see, he said.
He glanced at his wristcom, then rose.
We'll go check the quarters now, I think. But dawdle along the way, Savage said.
Alan shot him a sidelong glance.
I hope you haven't brought anything I'd have to throw out, he said. You are meant to set a good example.
Bennett followed them as they walked out of the room, his presence a silent reminder that Alan was under constant supervision. Alan tried to forget him as they made their way down the corridor and into the first set of quarters, where six pilots were waiting for them. Bags were resting on bunks, already open. A sealed box, marked for transfer to Talliman, rested on the floor. Alan nodded in approval, then turned a blind eye. Hopefully, the pilots wouldn't be foolish enough to actually send the box off the ship. He couldn't turn a blind eye to that. The pilots didn't have much, not when space was so tight. Alan inspected their bags anyway, noting the uniformity. The Navy had issued them with everything from basic uniforms and overalls to underwear and medical supplies. Alan made a mental note to check that everyone's medical records were up to date. Haddock didn't have a proper sick bay, with a doctor who had forced the crew to undergo regular checks, as he moved from bag to bag. The pilots had definitely done a good job of removing anything illicit.
Unless they didn't have anything illicit in the first place, he thought. But that's about as likely as me passing SAS selection.
Very good, he said, when he had finished.
The only item that had been remotely out of place was a pair of lacy panties, owned by Green. Alan had been careful not to ask. He was pretty sure he didn't want to know.
And now you can all relax until we start the first set of exercises.
Bennett nudged him as they left the compartment.
Men and women sleeping together? They're not men and women, Whitehead said. They're starfighter pilots.
Savage put on a mock falsetto.
Wing Commander, is it all right to sleep with a fellow pilot? Why, yes it is. Except you young pilots don't want to sleep.
No, they don't, Alan said.
He wasn't too concerned. Mixed wardrooms were a fact of naval life. And besides, it was against regulations for starfighter pilots to sleep together, at least when their fellows might catch them. Anyone who wanted to have an illicit affair would be better off waiting until they could go on shore leave.
It should be fine.
Bennett didn't look impressed.
And when it isn't?
Then we deal with it, Alan said.
The army did not have mixed barracks. It was actually quite rare for women to serve in the combat arms.
They're grown men and women.
They're starfighter pilots,
Whitehead said.
They'll be fine once we actually start drilling,
Savage said. And we'll start doing that in an hour.
Chapter 9.
Our orders seem to keep changing,
Abigail said.
She sat in her cabin, reclining on the bed, while Alan sat on the single chair.
Yesterday we were going to Picard. Today we're going to New Russia.
The diplomats are trying to smooth out the politics. Now the entire world knows what's happening,
Alan said.
He took a sip of his tea.
The great powers have never had to work together before.
Abigail nodded. The news had leaked 3 days ago, followed rapidly by a formal announcement. And so far, the Groundbounders had confirmed every negative stereotype the Belters held about them. Riots in the streets, panic buying. Anyone would think that a moon-sized starship had suddenly materialized in the night sky. The more thoughtful commenters had pointed out that the aliens were still dozens of light-years away. But the effect had been undermined by a couple of smartasses on the datanet, pointing out what the time delay actually meant. It was quite possible that the aliens were closer than they knew.
Not that the belt is doing much better, she conceded ruefully.
Entire settlements had gone dark, trying to hide from prowling alien starships.
We thought we might have to fight the ground pounders one day. Instead, we're allied with them against a far greater foe. We're due to depart in 2 days, she said. Or has our departure date been put back again?
I'm planning on the assumption that we'll be leaving on schedule,
Alan said.
We might be delayed again, but...
He shrugged. Abigail wondered how he could be so calm. On one hand, she was accustomed to schedule slips. On the other, these delays were caused by some idiot ground pounder who apparently thought he could move starships around like pieces on a chessboard. It was maddening to realize that her authority had been expanded in some ways, but circumscribed in others. And that she had to answer to a bureaucracy. She'd had to write more reports over the last couple of weeks than she'd had to write in the last 10 years of her captaincy. It was frustrating as hell to know that some requests would be met without question, but others would require detailed requests before some time server stamped approved on them. She met his eyes.
How do you handle it?
The delays?
Alan considered her question for a long moment.
They're part of military life, really. You get used to them.
It isn't very efficient,
Abigail pointed out dryly.
I'd be in deep shit if I was that inefficient.
We're not quite at the bottom of the supply chain, but we're almost there,
Alan said.
I'm not sure if we're above or below Ark Royal. They'll be more concerned with getting the fleet carriers and their escorts ready for action than us.
Ouch,
Abigail said. She leaned forward.
And the politics? Was there any update?
Nothing, really, Alan said. On one hand, we're all one big happy family. On the other, that family is scrabbling like a scrabbling family. We're supposed to be allies with the other spacefaring powers. But no one has managed to sort out a chain of command yet. Which is awkward, as we'll be heading to New Russia, unless someone changes our orders yet again.
Abigail nodded slowly. The naval bean counters didn't seem to believe that she deserved detailed updates. But she was an old hand at reading between the lines. New Russia was the largest human colony between Vera Cruz and Earth. The logical place for the multinational fleet to assemble. The aliens would have to punch their way through New Russia if they wanted to drive on Earth. Assuming, of course, that they knew anything about the human sphere's astrography. There was no way to be sure what they knew or didn't know. All the reports agreed that they could have captured navigation charts on Vera Cruz, but no one knew if they had.
And some talking head was screaming about information security on the datanet, she thought,
remembering the updates her family had forwarded to her.
They'll make life harder for everyone else. Now they're locking the stable doors after the horse has bolted.
She leaned back on the bed and picked up her mug. It was empty.
What do you think will happen?
She asked, as she started to search for something else to drink.
I mean, who'll be in command?
I think they won't care that much about a lowly escort carrier,
Alan said thoughtfully.
A fleet carrier? Sure, they'd care about a fleet carrier. But us? I don't know.
A fleet has to have an unquestioned chain of command,
Abigail said. Her fingers found the bottle she was searching for and pulled it out.
Pass over your mug. I think you need something a little stronger.
Alan looked doubtful.
I made my pilots send their alcohol back to the asteroid, he said. I really shouldn't be drinking.
You're off duty, Abigail reminded him. Please. I insist.
She kept her face impassive as he wrestled with his conscience. She'd looked him up in the shipboard records, but found nothing. Whatever Alan had done hadn't been considered important enough to add to the onboard encyclopedia. She was reluctant to try to ask through the datanet, if only because all messages and search requests still went through the sensors on the asteroid. Someone might object to her trying to find out what her XO had actually done to get himself thrown in jail.
And I need to know before we leave, she told herself.
Normally, she would have respected someone's privacy, but matters were far from normal.
Even if it does mean trying to get him drunk enough to loosen his tongue.
Alan surrendered and held out his mug. Abigail splashed a generous helping into his mug, then filled her own. Her alcohol tolerance was pretty high. She'd had all kinds of minor improvements spliced into her genome, but she reminded herself to be careful anyway. She was too old to go to a bar, get extremely drunk, and wake up the following morning in a stranger's bed. Her parents hadn't been particularly sympathetic when she'd been nursing hangovers either.
Cheers,
Alan said. He took a swig and choked.
What the hell is this stuff? Paint stripper?
Genuine firewater from Ceres, Abigail said. I was told that naval types could hold their beer.
This isn't beer, Alan said. This is...
He took another swig.
I suppose it grows on you.
It does, Abigail agreed. You just have to drink enough of it.
She took a sip herself, wincing slightly as it burned her throat. No one bought firewater for the taste. Back when she'd been young, it had been considered the height of manliness to drink a whole bottle without pausing to take a breath. In hindsight, they'd all been very lucky not to die of alcohol poisoning, or be shunned for putting everyone else in danger. Belters didn't care if someone drank themselves silly every night, but they'd take immediate steps if the drunkard tried to pilot a shuttlecraft while drunk.
We were silly bastards and bitches back then, she thought ruefully. Out on leave, away from our parents and commanders. We wanted fun, and we didn't care about the price.
She watched Alan drink, torn between amusement and a peculiar kind of guilt. Alan had been cooling his heels in jail, not sunning himself on a beach. The firewater was probably the first alcohol he had had for 5 years, perhaps longer. And he was gulping it down as though it truly was water. It wouldn't be long before he was completely blotto.
He isn't going to thank me for this, she told herself. The hangover alone will feel like an elephant stamping on his skull.
She told herself firmly that it was necessary. She needed to know what he had done. And yet, she kicked herself mentally. She was the commanding officer of a starship, not some random stranger. Duty came before anything else, even morality. If she was prepared to pass judgment on a member of her crew, she was sure as hell prepared to get someone drunk so she could get some answers. And yet...
I think you've had enough, she said, as she filled his mug again. I drank too much when I was a young woman.
So did I,
Alan said woozily.
I smuggled 2 bottles of beer into the dorm when I was in school. The headmaster found out. Too late. We'd already drunk the beer.
Oh dear,
Abigail said. She felt her lips thinning in disapproval. How old had Alan been when he'd smuggled beer into his school? Ground Pounders kept children in school until they were 16, at least. They didn't seem to understand the value of a practical education.
or the importance of allowing a child to grow up in a house filled with love.
I hope you didn't do it when you were older.
I feel like a heel, Alan said.
His voice steadied just for a second.
I tell my pilots not to pull the dumb shit I pulled when I was a pilot. Do you have any idea how much dumb shit I pulled when I was a pilot?
I pulled a lot of dumb shit when I was a crewwoman,
Abigail said. She wanted to encourage him to talk.
I was lucky my uncle didn't just throw me out of the airlock. If I hadn't been family.
Family, Alan said. You can't trust family, you know.
Abigail frowned.
They're all I can trust, she said. Who else would I trust?
That's what I thought, Alan said.
He swallowed the rest of his drink, then coughed so violently that she thought he was going to throw up.
Family. Who can you trust but family? And then the bitch cheated on me.
The bitch?
My wife, Alan said.
He put the mug down.
She cheated on me.
Abigail studied him for a long moment. She'd heard of the concept of adultery, but it wasn't something the Belt took particularly seriously. Group marriages were the norm, after all. She wouldn't fault her husbands or wives if they wanted to have a fling outside the group, or if they wanted to bring in someone new. It wasn't as if she could be with her partners 24/7.
There I was. Working me butt off to ensure a stable income for her and the kids, while she was fucking the neighbor. That asshole was a friend, I thought. Who knew he was bonking my wife? I didn't know.
The words came tumbling out.
I thought she loved me. I thought she supported my career. And then I walk in on her, being fucked by the fucker, by that fucker Slater. And I killed her.
Abigail recoiled in shock. She knew that some group marriages had broken down spectacularly, normally because some of the partners were too immature to make the relationship work. But she'd never heard of one that ended in murder. It was horrific. The mere thought was disgusting. She'd had disagreements with her partners, everyone had, but she would never kill them. The worst that could happen was an acrimonious division of the family's wealth and permanent separation.
They put a murderer on my ship, she thought numbly. And not just any murderer, either.
She would have been happier, she thought, if Alan had murdered a random stranger. Or perhaps not. She could see the Navy's logic, even if she didn't like it. Alan had killed once, under conditions that were unlikely to reoccur. But to her, Alan had committed an unspeakable betrayal. He turned against his own family.
And his wife's adultery does not justify her death,
Abigail thought.
Their kids grew up without either of their parents.
Perhaps it was different for ground pounders, her mind suggested. Ground pounders were immature children, lacking the maturity and common sense of the asteroid belt. Alan might have every right to think that he, not his wife, had been betrayed. But it still wasn't anything like enough to excuse murder. The ground pounders had clearly agreed. Alan had been in jail after all. He'd been looking at another 5 years in custody before his eventual release. She listened as the drunken words came bubbling out, feeling sick. She'd wanted to know, hadn't she? And now she did know. What had the other convicts done? Did she want to know now?
And he wouldn't have had anything alcoholic for years, she reminded herself sharply. I probably gave him far too much to drink.
She dug into her emergency kit and found a sober up.
Here,
she said. She jabbed a finger at the washroom hatch.
You can use this in there.
Alan eyed her for a long moment, then took the tab and rose, stumbling as he walked into the bathroom. Abigail allowed herself a sigh of relief, even though she knew she'd probably have to clean up the mess afterwards. Thankfully, Alan didn't seem to be so far gone that he'd need help to use the injector tab, then keep his head pointed in the right direction as he threw up. Abigail would have felt sorry for him. She'd used enough sober-ups to know she'd prefer a hangover, if she hadn't known what he'd done. He had murdered his wife.
You still have to work with him, she thought. And now?
She sighed. She'd needed to know. But now she'd have to pay the price for her curiosity. Alan felt his legs tremble as he forced himself back to his feet. His mouth tasted awful, worse than the time the matron had washed his mouth out with soap for swearing at a particularly unpleasant teacher. The old crone had been a horror, the kind of person who should never be allowed authority over anyone. He'd been privately delighted when she'd died a year after he'd left the school. The old boys' club had joked that the only reason anyone had attended her funeral had been to make sure she was actually dead. He turned on the water and washed his mouth thoroughly, spitting out the water into the toilet. He'd drunk something, and he'd gotten drunk. Abigail had gotten him drunk, and then... And then what? His mind wasn't quite clear. The sober-up had chased all the alcohol out of his system at the cost of making him feel thoroughly unwell. A wave of guilt and self-recrimination overwhelmed him. He told the pilots time and time again that they were not to even think about touching alcohol. And now he'd managed to get drunk.
Fuck, he said.
His mouth still tasted awful.
Fire water.
Someone had probably relabeled a bottle of bleach or hull cleanser or something. His thoughts were still tangled. What the hell had he been doing?
Fuck it.
He turned and stumbled back into the tiny cabin. Abigail was sitting on the bed, fully dressed. He supposed that was a relief, at least. There would be no embarrassed breakfasts or embarrassed screaming, not like he'd endured as a young pilot. He'd thought his hard drinking days were over after he'd been promoted out of his cockpit. A CAG might outrank his subordinates, but he wasn't allowed anything like as much leeway. It didn't seem fair, somehow.
You murdered your wife,
Abigail said flatly. Alan stared back at her, too woozy to be angry. The sober-up might have spared him a hangover and the embarrassment of being revealed as a hypocrite, but it hadn't made him feel better. Of course not. That would have been too easy. A moment later, the underlying meaning of her words dawned on him. She knew what he'd done, and that meant he'd told her. He took a breath. The air tasted awful, too.
I know what I did.
Really?
Abigail said.
You left your children without their parents?
I know what I did,
Alan repeated sharply. His head started to throb the moment he raised his voice.
I've had plenty of time to regret it.
All the regret in the world will not bring her back,
Abigail said.
If you'd lived in the belt, you would have been executed for your crime.
A dozen answers ran through Alan's head. He said nothing.
Fuck it,
Abigail said. She jerked a hand at the hatch.
Get out.
Alan looked down at his shirt, now stained, and then did as he was told. Abigail hated him now. So what? He'd always known their working relationship would be a little strained. They would just have to be professional about it. He stepped outside and leaned against the bulkhead, silently grateful that it was shipboard night. One very definite advantage of serving on an escort carrier was that there were times when most of the crew was sleeping. A fleet carrier operated 24/7.
That'll have to change, he told himself. We can't afford to be caught with our pants down.
He sighed. There was no way to hide the fact he'd fucked up. Allowing himself to get drunk had been foolish. And he hadn't realized the danger until it had been too late. He was a lightweight now. One sniff of the barmaid's apron, and his mouth had run away with him.
It was a little more than a sniff, he thought. I drank.
He groaned.
Not being sure of how much he'd actually drunk was not a good sign.
Shaking his head, he stumbled down the corridor. He needed something to eat before he went back to his bunk. A sandwich, perhaps, or even a ration bar. He wasn't fussy.
And pray that Bennett never finds out about this, he thought crossly. That would really put the cat amongst the pigeons.
Chapter 10.
They look as though they're drunk,
Poddy said. She jabbed a finger at the newly installed display.
Mum?
Abigail gave her a sharp look, then cursed herself under her breath. Poddy didn't know. Of course she didn't know. She'd simply looked at what passed for a starfighter formation and made a caustic remark. Abigail made a silent promise to do something to make it up to Poddy later. The poor girl didn't deserve a fright.
I got someone drunk because I wanted to know what he was hiding,
she reminded herself crossly.
And what does that make me?
It's deliberate, Anson said. If he'd picked up on the sudden tension, he said nothing.
They don't fly in predictable formations because they'd make themselves easy targets.
Abigail nodded slowly. There was no such thing as an orderly formation in space, not outside the handful of military displays. Better to keep a wide gap between expensive starships than risk a collision. Not that accidental collisions were that common, she had to admit. The odds of accidentally ramming another starship were only marginally higher than the odds of flying through an asteroid field and hitting one of the asteroids. She'd always laughed when she'd seen ground pounder depictions of the asteroid belt. The asteroids had been so tightly clustered together that a starfighter could barely fit through the gaps.
Instead of being so far apart that you could fly every starship in the human sphere through the gap and still have room to spare,
she thought wryly.
Anyone who hits an asteroid is either blind or trying to scam the insurance company. It still looks bad,
Poddy said. She glanced at her mother.
I'd be in trouble if I flew like that. You're not trying to dodge incoming fire,
Abigail pointed out.
And if you tried to fly Archie like a starfighter, you'd probably rip the ship apart.
She broke off as Poddy's console chimed.
What's that? An important message from the Admiralty,
Poddy said.
It's being automatically forwarded to the XO.
Oh, goody, Abigail said. She keyed her console, bringing up the latest set of readiness reports. Her console bleeped.
What now?
Captain, we have finally received our official orders,
Alan said. His voice was very steady, very calm. If she hadn't known he'd been drunk last night, thanks to her, she would never have believed it.
Please could you join me down here to discuss them?
As you wish,
Abigail said. She rose.
Anson, you have the bridge.
The CIC was as cramped as always, with Alan, his three subordinates and his shadow seated in uncomfortably small chairs. Maddie made her way out of the compartment as Abigail entered, leaving her alone with the men. Abigail didn't really blame her. The compartment was uncomfortably small with four big men, let alone Maddie and Abigail herself. She had never been claustrophobic, but part of her just wanted to insist they took the discussion somewhere else. Alan tapped a key. A holographic star chart appeared in front of them.
The multinational fleet, 8 fleet carriers, which will join 4 more at New Russia, is already departing the system now that the last-minute preparations have been completed, he said. That will give them an overall strength of 12 carriers, 2 of which are ours. The Russians will hold overall command, apparently, as they have committed 6 fleet carriers to the formation. I don't think I need to remind you that this will leave them with only 3 carriers in home waters.
New Russia is also their world,
Abigail pointed out tersely.
Correct, Alan said. Regardless, the great powers have decided that humanity will be making its stand at New Russia. Updated reports suggest that alien probes have moved into a number of systems on the far side of New Russia. He nodded to the display, indicating the red icons. And an attack on the system itself must be imminent. Of course, it might already have taken place. All our reports are at least a week out of date.
He tapped the display again.
The MNF will proceed at its best possible speed to New Russia,
which will mean abandoning the fleet train. Accordingly, our task, and that of 5 other escort carriers, is to shepherd the fleet train to New Russia. Once we arrive, we will either be assigned to protect the system's installations or escort a convoy on the return trip to Earth.
Abigail did the calculations in her head.
We'd need at least 3 weeks to get there, she mused as she studied the star chart. More like 4, really.
We've been ordered to proceed at our best possible speed, too.
Adlin looked downcast for a moment.
Unfortunately, that will be the speed of the slowest ship in the convoy.
Ouch, Abigail said. And if we get attacked?
We have orders to defend ourselves, if fired upon,
Alan said.
If we detect their ships, we have orders to attempt to make contact. An updated first contact packet has already been uploaded to the database. Ideally, we should be able to talk to them, which will hopefully end the war.
Abigail shook her head in mild disbelief. She'd been briefed on first contact protocols when she'd assumed command, although most of the Belter crews had believed they were just a waste of time and energy. There was no such thing as aliens. And even if aliens did exist, what were the odds of an interstellar freighter making first contact? Now, such precautions were starting to look prophetic.
There's no reason to assume that they'll agree to open communications, Savage said. So far, all they've done is point their weapons at us and opened fire.
Pointing your weapon at someone is a form of communication, Bennett pointed out. And so is opening fire. I don't think anyone in the Admiralty believes that we can convince the aliens to back off, Alan said. I'd say that someone in the Houses of Parliament pushed for us to try to make peaceful contact, even if the aliens show no apparent interest in it.
So we are being put at risk because some political oxygen thief wants to feel good about himself,
Abigail growled. The Belt, at least, demanded a certain level of competence from its leaders.
Are we allowed to fire first?
If we believe we're under threat, Alan said.
He shot her an unreadable look.
That will be your call, Captain.
Thank you, Abigail said sourly. When do they want us to depart?
Yesterday, Savage said.
The fleet train is moving to the RV point now, Alan said.
He didn't look pleased, just for a second.
We'll link up with them in a couple of hours, then depart when Commodore Banks says so.
Joy,
Abigail said. She'd never liked flying in convoy. It hadn't been necessary very often, save for a handful of drills. Space pirates were the stuff of pulp fiction and bad movies that were no more realistic than the muscles and chests displayed by the actors. But then aliens had been the stuff of bad fiction only a few weeks ago.
Do you know Commodore Banks?
He's CEO of HMAS Melbourne, Alan said. Australian, not British. Other than that, I've never met the man. He'll have a good record if they put him in charge of an oversized light cruiser, but...
He shrugged.
Read the files. I dare say they'll be more informative.
As long as he isn't one of those officers who think us merchants are all smuggling something,
Abigail said.
That might be bad.
It might, Alan agreed. Remind your crew to make sure they update their wills before we depart. The odds are not on our side.
Abigail nodded tightly.
Is there anything else?
I'll be recalling the starfighters shortly,
Alan said.
We'll continue drills as we plod our merry way to New Russia.
Very good,
Abigail said. She turned and left the compartment, keying her wristcom as she made her way back to the bridge. It was a relief to finally have orders, she thought, even though they were going to be away from their homes for at least 2 months. She'd hoped she could swing a trip to Ceres, but the Royal Navy hadn't been interested in ensuring her crewers got some shore leave somewhere away from their ship. VR had its limitations, after all. No matter how detailed it was, there was no way to forget that the user was on a cramped starship.
We'll be departing in 2 hours, she said as she entered the bridge. If any of you want to record a final message, do it now.
She leaned back in her chair and watched as word spread rapidly through the ship. If nothing else, the constant series of orders and replacement orders had ensured that her ship was ready to depart at a moment's notice. The starfighters were already returning to the ship, landing one by one in the hangar bay. She grimaced as she silently calculated just how long it would take to recover all 24 fighters. Doing that while taking fire, or waiting to cross a tramline, would be a nightmare. They might have to abandon some of their pilots just to save the ship.
Unless we have them latch onto the hull, she thought.
It was theoretically possible.
But that would be dangerous too.
Her console bleeped.
I've not gotten the final set of supplies from the station,
Vasilios Drakopoulos said grimly.
Should we be pressing them?
Yeah,
Abigail said. In theory, they could operate without so many spare parts. But in practice, a single failure might doom the entire ship. She had no illusions about how highly the Royal Navy valued her ship. They wouldn't have given her a murderer for an XO if they considered her anything other than expendable. But she liked to think that her crew were worth a little more.
Send me the request. I'll forward it to them.
Someone had definitely lit a fire under the bean counters, she thought, as the 2 hours ticked steadily away. She'd expected a fight, but instead, the transfer was authorized within seconds. A team of dockyard workers even moved the pallet to Haddock, rather than waste time scrabbling over who would have the honor of doing the work. The spare parts were neatly stowed away, just as the timer reached zero. It was time to go.
Anson, set a course for the RV point, she ordered,
as soon as she'd checked with Alan.
And take us out.
Aye, Captain,
Anson said. Abigail felt her heart starting to pound in her chest as a low quiver ran through the ship. She kept a wary eye on the status displays, trying to reassure herself that everything was going to be fine. The dockyard workers had done a good job convincing equipment from several different eras to work together. But she was too experienced a spacer to believe that it would work perfectly. A tiny error in the programming nodes might cause the entire system to crash, no matter how many precautions had been worked into the system. Hell, too many precautions might bring the system down by themselves. And if that happened while they were a long way from help, they might be in real trouble.
There's no might about it,
she thought, as they slipped away from the asteroid.
We will be in trouble.
She keyed her console, bringing up the long-range sensor display. The military-grade sensors were good, good enough that she was seriously tempted to try to keep them after their military service was over. Hundreds of starships, inter-system spacecraft and shuttles were clearly visible on the sensors, making their way backwards and forwards across the Sol system. Tiny icons followed them, warning of time delays and potentially inaccurate projection. Abigail felt a flicker of contempt mingled with amusement. Belters didn't need computers to tell them about the damn time delay.
We'll be at our destination in 3 hours,
Anson said.
Unless you want to redline the drive.
Bad idea,
Abigail said flatly. They'd been assured that the compensators could handle the acceleration. But one failure, and everyone on board would be smashed against the nearest bulkhead. There were plenty of redundancies worked into the system, yet it wasn't something she was inclined to test.
Keep us moving safely, please.
She leaned back in her chair and forced herself to relax. It wasn't easy. They were moving at a speed most ground pounders would have found unimaginable, yet they were crawling along compared to a warship or a starfighter. HMAS Melbourne could give Haddock a few hours' start and still overhaul her before she reached safety. It was hard to believe the aliens couldn't catch them either, which meant,
we'll be a magnet for trouble, she thought. And as long as we soak up missiles aimed at the bigger ships, the Admiralty won't care.
Captain,
Drakopoulos said. His face appeared in front of her.
The drives appear to be living up to their promises.
Very good,
Abigail said. She sat upright, crossly.
And the power cores?
They appear to be working at an acceptable level,
Dracopoulos said. He didn't sound particularly pleased.
But you know my concerns.
Abigail nodded, curtly. A rule of thumb, a very basic rule of thumb, was never to rely on anything the crew couldn't fix if it broke. Fixing a fusion core on board ship was a nightmare, but being stranded in interstellar space would be worse. But the latest generation of fusion cores were designed to be impossible to repair, at least without specialized and extremely expensive tools. Dracopoulos had objected strongly to having them installed on the starship. If the Navy hadn't had her by the short hairs, Abigail would have objected too.
We can rely on batteries long enough to get us back to safety, she said.
That wouldn't be pleasant. Everything would have to be cut back to the bare minimum, but it was the only way to stay alive.
Make sure the power cells remain charged.
Aye, Captain,
Dracopoulos said. His face vanished. Abigail sighed and reached for her datapad, bringing up the raw data. The newer systems all appeared to be operating according to projections, something that worried her more than she cared to admit. Nothing was perfect, not even military-grade starship components. Experience told her that something was going to fail, sooner rather than later. And when it did, it would fail at the worst possible time.
Maybe we'll stress test them later, she thought. That might tell us something useful.
The display changed as Haddock approached the convoy. It was an impressive sight, even though the cynical part of Abigail's mind insisted that another word for convoy was target. 40 freighters, 5 other escort carriers, and a trio of warships. Perhaps they were enough to beat off an alien attack. Perhaps not. She couldn't help wondering if sneaking the freighters through individually would be a better idea. Hiding the freighters in the interstellar void would make them immensely difficult to detect.
We're being hailed, Boddy said. On screen?
Yes, please,
Abigail said. She straightened, reluctantly, when a middle-aged man in military uniform materialized in front of her. His uniform was similar to the Royal Navy's, but different enough to make it clear that it wasn't the same Navy. His brown hair was barely visible under a peaked cap.
Captain Harrison, the man said.
He had an odd accent, one she couldn't place.
I am Commodore Banks, Leo Banks. Thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome, Abigail said. Where do you want us?
My staff will send you the details,
Banks informed her.
I just wish to welcome you personally.
They exchanged a few more pieces of small talk before Banks withdrew, closing the connection. Abigail wasn't sure if she should be flattered or concerned that Banks had called her personally. It wasn't as if they had any real connection, after all. But then she wasn't a naval officer by career. Banks might have thought it would be better to be polite to her rather than risk causing offense.
Which makes him more or less unique, she thought wryly. Every other military officer I've met has been rather full of himself. Captain,
Poddy said. She glanced back, indicating her console.
I've received our orders.
Abigail stood and peered over Poddy's shoulder. Haddock had been assigned to a position at the rear of the formation, covering the other workhorses. She wondered, absently, if someone thought they were meant to be a Q-ship, then dismissed the thought. Haddock could no longer pass for a harmless freighter. The starfighter launching tube was a direct giveaway.
And the weapons and sensor blisters on our hull, she told herself.
Even from a distance, Haddock no longer looked harmless.
And our power signature is different, too. Take us into formation, she ordered shortly.
Thankfully, they weren't expected to follow a perfect formation. Banks had a working brain, if nothing else. Freighters and converted carriers were hardly designed to turn on a dime.
And then inform the XO of our updated orders. I can take them in person,
Anson said.
He told me I could use the simulators while the pilots were outside the ship.
Abigail frowned. She didn't want Anson and Alan to become friendly. And yet she had no way to stop it without revealing far too much.
Hopefully, a few hours in the simulators would convince Anson that he didn't want to be a starfighter pilot. It wasn't as if he was flying a worker bee or orbital shuttle. A starfighter would be far less forgiving of mistakes.
And if he does want to join after all, she told herself, he can go to the training center instead of learning here.
Sure,
she said. But wait until we're in position.
Chapter 11. It was impossible to tell, with the naked eye, that the convoy had entered the Terra Nova system. The stars were still unblinking, glaring down at the tiny humans who had dared to enter their domain. There was no visible difference between one system and the next, not as far as anyone could tell. Alan felt as though he was completely alone in infinite space. He peered out of the starfighter's cockpit, futilely looking for the other fighters, and the convoy. It was useless, of course. A starship, even a fleet carrier, was little more than a speck of dust on an interplanetary scale. He wouldn't see the ships with the naked eye until he was far too close for comfort. Even knife-range starfighter combat was fought with instruments rather than anything else. He wouldn't even see the enemy starfighter that killed him if it got into fighting range.
Assuming they have starfighters, he thought.
He'd read all the speculations, but in the end, they were just speculations. The aliens might have starfighters, or they might have gone down a whole different route. Battleships instead of starfighters, perhaps. Or something so alien that humanity had never thought of it.
There are too many unknowns in this business.
His intercom crackled.
Sir, ready for some fun?
Green, Alan thought. The younger man had been a minor problem over the last few days, but thankfully he seemed to be shaping up as the convoy moved away from Earth. That was a relief. Alan would have hated to lock Green in his cabin until they returned home.
If he wasn't such a good flyer, he would have been discharged long ago.
Ready, he said. He leaned forward, resting his hands on the controls. It had been so long since he'd flown a real starfighter, but it was like riding a bicycle. Once you got the hang of it and took a number of tumbles, you never quite forgot. Thankfully, he'd had a few days in the simulators before taking a real starfighter out into space.
Switching to practice mode.
Now. A red light appeared on his display, a warning that he'd be firing harmless laser pulses rather than flechette rounds. He checked and double-checked, just to make absolutely sure. There'd been enough vague sensor contacts over the last week to make him reluctant to send his pilots out without the ability to shoot back at whatever they encountered, even though he wasn't inclined to believe that the aliens had already reached Terra Nova. But there was no way to be entirely sure. If half the unexplained sensor contacts were real, the aliens had already infested the human sphere.
And they could have crawled through the tramlines long before reaching Vera Cruz, he thought, as he kicked up the drive. They might have been watching us for a long time.
Ice ran down his spine. Interplanetary space was vast, easily large enough to hide an entire fleet of alien scouts, as long as they were careful. The aliens could have sneaked a fleet of battleships through the tramlines and attacked Earth right at the start. They would have caught the human race completely by surprise. But they hadn't. What did that mean? Had they attacked Vera Cruz without realizing that they were dealing with a spacefaring race?
Let's go, sir,
Green said.
Attack pattern Omega?
Herring squadron, form up on me, Alan ordered. And go.
He felt his lips curve into a smile as the starfighters picked up speed, falling into a formation that looked like organized chaos. A civilian would see it as nothing more than randomized flying, but it was far more than that. Computers handled most point defense weapons these days, and computers were very good at picking out patterns. A starfighter that flew on a predictable trajectory was dead the moment it strayed into range. The formation might look bad, but it would keep its pilots alive. It wasn't as though they were putting on a show for the king's birthday.
And they'd be keeping us out of sight if they did,
he reminded himself.
The Red Arrows would be putting on that show.
The enemy starfighters moved away from the convoy, spreading out to intercept the incoming starfighters. Alan switched his weapons to automatic, trusting the computers to take shots at targets of opportunity while he concentrated on flying. New alerts popped up in his display as the enemy starfighters converged, opening fire with savage intensity. They had good reason to try to break up his formation, he knew. They could kill his entire squadron and still lose, if they lost their carrier too. Starfighter life support wouldn't last anything like long enough for the starfighters to reach Terra Nova.
And in a real battle, we might be in the midst of some unexplored star system, he thought.
An enemy starfighter snapped past him, evading his shot with practiced ease.
There might be nowhere to go.
Stay focused on the objective, he ordered curtly.
The pilots were getting drawn into dogfights, trying to win their spurs rather than complete their attack runs.
Don't let them lure you away.
He winced as the death toll started to mount. Starfighters were fragile. A single hit was almost always enough to destroy them, although there were vague tales of pilots who ejected just in time and survived long enough to be picked up. Alan had practiced bailouts when he'd been in training, but his instructors had warned that the odds of survival were very low indeed. There was no point in forcing his pilots to bail out in the middle of a practice mission.
Got him!
Green caroled.
Bart owes me a drink tonight!
Yes, Alan said.
He checked the exercise results as the two sides grew apart, the brief engagement over in a matter of moments. The timer insisted they had been skirmishing for 10 minutes, but Alan didn't believe it.
And they also managed to protect their carrier.
He shook his head in annoyance. The pilots were all hotshots. They wouldn't have been allowed to graduate if they weren't hotshots, but they weren't a team. Not yet. Too many of them had tried to rack up their kills, rather than take out the actual target. They'd need to do more exercises, he told himself. Mike Whitehead would have to force them to keep their eyes on the prize.
And Green and his fellows don't make that easy, Alan reflected. They're more interested in personal glory than anything else. Form up on me, he ordered curtly. We'll reset the exercise. Kipper can have a go at attacking the carrier instead.
Thank you, sir,
Wing Commander Mark Savage said.
We look forward to getting those drinks back.
Alan snorted to himself. There were no drinks on the ship, nothing alcoholic at least. If someone had set up a still, and it was practically a tradition, it was very well hidden. His warnings and blood-curdling threats had apparently been taken to heart. He cursed under his breath as he zoomed back into position. For all his harsh words and promises of dire retribution, he'd still managed to get drunk with Abigail. There were words for commanding officers who didn't practice what they preached. None of them were pleasant. He opened his senses, checking the entire convoy. Commodore Banks had been surprisingly understanding under the circumstances. All of the escort carriers were practicing hard, although it would be a while before they were ready for actual war games. Alan hoped that time would come soon. Practicing attack runs on Haddock was growing tedious, even for him. The chance to engage someone new, someone unpredictable, couldn't be missed.
It isn't as if we're going to be engaging the enemy carriers ourselves, he thought. They'll keep us on milk runs until the end of the war.
The part of him that had been a hotshot pilot, still was in many ways, thought that was dreadfully unfair. No one became a starfighter pilot without a thirst for glory, without the urge to paint the hull with as many enemy silhouettes as possible. The certain knowledge that they'd never see real combat, not unless they were very unlucky, burned at him. He and his squadrons would never have a chance for real glory. He shook his head in annoyance. Haddock wasn't designed for fleet operations. Her only role in the line of battle was to provide a single flight deck, if she didn't soak up a handful of missiles instead. Alan shrugged, dispassionately. Haddock couldn't pass for a fleet carrier, and if she did, somehow, it wouldn't last.
The enemy would throw everything up to and including the kitchen sink at a ship that couldn't hope to survive. Haddock would be vaporized by the missiles, and that would be the end.
And every other pilot in the fleet has a better record than you, his thoughts mocked him sardonically. They didn't kill their wives.
All right, he said, as they fell into formation. Let's go. He tensed as Skipper Squadron roared down on their position. Like it or not, they were confined to escort duties for the foreseeable future. And they had to practice, just to make sure they were ready for a real attack. And yet half of his pilots were still too intent on personal glory. Green allowed himself to be pulled out of formation, just long enough for two enemy starfighters to sneak past him and fall into an attack run. If they'd been carrying torpedoes, Alan noted, they would have had a very good chance at taking out the carrier.
A real fleet carrier might soak up the hits, Alan thought, making a mental note to berate Green later. But an escort carrier doesn't have a chance.
He keyed his console.
Well, gentlemen, he said, our ride home appears to be nothing more than a cloud of expanding dust. We're all dead.
Sucks to be you, I guess,
Flight Lieutenant Patsy Govan said.
And now we're going to run. Coward!
Green said.
As you were,
Alan said, before the banter could turn into a real argument.
Herring Squadron will be buying the drinks when we actually go on leave.
Blast!
Green said.
Hey, sir. Is there any prospect of shore leave on New Russia?
I have no idea,
Alan said curtly. He rather doubted it. The escort carrier crews wouldn't be on the top of the list for shore leave, if there was a list. It was far more likely that they'd simply be turned around in order to escort another convoy home.
Return to the barn, ladies and gentlemen. We'll go over the engagement this evening.
He turned the starfighter slowly, wishing he could remain outside the ship. It hadn't been easy to put himself on the flight roster, not when Bennett had clearly been suspicious of his motivations. But then, he had had a good reason to go flying. He needed to understand what his pilots could and couldn't do before it was too late. It had been too long since he'd flown a starfighter for himself.
But at least I remembered how to fly, he told himself. And I can go out again later.
He peered forward, straining his eyes as a faint flicker of light slowly became the escort carrier. He'd never really understood why the designers had given the starfighters cockpits. There was no way he could land on the carrier without using his instruments. But he had to admit there was something reassuring about being able to see his mothership with the naked eye. Space was his home. He hadn't realized how much he'd missed it until he had been thrown into jail. But it was also utterly lethal. The vacuum would kill him if he popped open the cockpit. A single mistake could get them all killed.
Maybe I'll take one last flight after the war, he thought, and simply never come back.
His threat receiver lit up, red icons flashing over the display. Alan reacted instinctively, yanking the starfighter to one side as something flashed past him. Newer alerts blinked up, warning him that the carrier had opened fire. Opened fire on him. He heard someone yelping in shock over the command network, curses echoing through his ears as the starfighters scattered. They were all far too close to the suddenly hostile carrier for comfort.
Cease fire! He snapped.
He threw the starfighter into a series of evasive maneuvers as another round of pellets shot past him. Those were real projectiles. Was someone trying to kill him? Bennett? Or Abigail? Or... none of them made sense. Bennett wouldn't have any trouble killing Alan and convincing everyone else that it had been an unfortunate incident, if he wished.
I say again, cease fire!
The threat receiver blanked, so sharply he thought it had gone on the blink. He stared at it for a long moment, then looked up at the carrier. Or where the carrier should be. What the hell should they do? Fly to one of the other carriers, or...
Sir, I've disengaged the point defense system,
Mike Whitehead said. The acting CAG sounded shaken. Blue-on-blue incidents were rare, but they did happen.
You should be safe to return to the ship.
Make sure you isolate the entire system, Alan ordered stiffly. I want to know exactly what happened.
He felt his heart begin to race as he guided the starfighter back towards the carrier. He'd expect an enemy carrier to fire on him, of course, but a friendly ship. Even if it was just a glitch, it boded ill for the future. And what if it wasn't a glitch? What if it had been attempted murder? Alan thought his pilots and support crews didn't know what he'd done, but it wasn't impossible that one of them had found out. They could have sent a query back home if they'd had any reason to suspect that he was more than just another starfighter pilot who hadn't made the transition to command track.
And someone on Earth could dig up the news records, he thought numbly.
He wasn't the only person who happened to be called Alan Campbell, but it was quite possible that he was the only starfighter pilot of that name.
They'd know who I was, and what I'd done.
He tensed as the carrier grew larger and larger, until it dominated the viewport, grimly aware that he might be picked off at point-blank range. But nothing happened. His starfighter landed neatly on the deck, automatically moving forward and through a pair of airlocks into the next chamber. Alan opened the cockpit as soon as the starfighter had come to a halt, jumping down to the flight deck rather than wait for the ground crew to bring him the ladder.
Damn it,
he thought, as he felt his body start to shake. He hadn't shook so badly since his first flight, years ago.
What happened?
He made his way to the hatch and stepped through, trying to keep from showing any sign of tension or fear. He'd thought he'd understood combat, but this. An accident would be bad enough, but at least it would be an accident. It was not knowing that tore at him. Jail hadn't been too bad, all things considered. Colchester was better run than some of the civilian hellholes. Civilian warders had a reputation for everything from beating prisoners to sexually abusing them. But the Redcaps had been strictly professional. None of them had tried to kill him. His wristcom bleeped.
Sir, the remainder of the pilots are landing,
Whitehead said.
Their timing isn't good.
Call a general meeting for 1900 hours,
Alan said. He fought to control the shakes. He'd been in danger before, but this. He pushed the thought aside sharply.
Inform the pilots that there is to be no chatter until the meeting. They can go get some food or something, but there is to be no discussion until a full investigation is held.
Yes, sir.
Alan ran his hand through his hair. It felt sweaty. He'd enjoyed being outside the ship, right up until the moment Haddock had tried to kill him. It was a grim reminder that nothing could be fully trusted, not even a piece of equipment that had been checked and rechecked time and time again. Just for a moment, he thought he understood the neo-villagers he'd seen in the countryside. They'd tried to go back to an era of thatched cottages and small fields that had never really existed, save in story and song. And while he'd thought they were silly at the time, he understood them now. Their lives were not dependent on technology.
And yet, they'd be dead if an alien fleet materialized in their skies,
he reminded himself sourly. Unarmed primitives wouldn't stand a chance against modern firepower.
Or even if they caught something dangerous.
He forced himself to stand up straight. He'd go for a shower, perhaps grab a ration bar or two. By then, Abigail and Bennett would probably have completed a preliminary investigation. And then, he shook his head. A glitch would be bad. Worse, perhaps, than a deliberate attempt at murder. The prospect of losing control over the ship was terrifying. What would go next? Life support? There was no shortage of horror stories about starships that had slowly poisoned their own crews when the life support systems had glitched. He'd thought the stories existed to remind crews not to take anything for granted. But now he wasn't so sure. A single flaw in the air mix might kill the entire crew.
And if we can't rely on the ship, he mused,
What can we rely on?
Chapter 12.
I want a full explanation, Abigail said.
Her eyes swept the compartment.
What the fuck happened?
She looked from face to face. Alan was pale. He'd clearly had a nasty shock, even though he was trying to hide it. Beside him, Maddie looked worried. She wasn't guilty, Abigail was sure. But her motherly instincts told her that Maddie expected to be blamed for whatever had gone wrong. The two squadron commanders and Bennett appeared grim. They, and a handful of their subordinates, had been tearing apart the point defense system, trying to find out what had gone wrong. Maddie cleared her throat.
As far as I can tell, there was a glitch in the point defense sensor node, she said. The system managed to confuse two files, and the logic subroutines failed, and...
Abigail gave her a sharp look.
And what? The computers believed two things to be true at once, Maddie said. On one hand, it believed that we might be under attack at any moment. On the other, it knew we were carrying out training exercises. I think the system basically classed our starfighters as the enemy, tripping the automatic point defense system as the starfighters moved into engagement range.
Whitehead frowned.
So the computers thought we were carrying out a live fire exercise? No, sir, Maddie said. The point defense system is programmed to engage, automatically, any targets that come within torpedo range. When we go to battle stations, the human element is completely locked out of the loop. There just isn't time to ask for orders. When our starfighters approached, it defaulted to emergency protocols, classed everything as a potential enemy, and opened fire. It simply didn't have time to reassess the situation.
She took a breath.
The full report will be a little more complex, she added. But I think I've passed out the basics. So it was a glitch, Abigail said. And not an attempt at...
She allowed her voice to harden.
Outright murder.
Maddie paled.
I'm not a trained investigator, Captain, she said. All I can say is what I believe to have happened. Right, Abigail said.
The Belt Federation accepted that accidents happened. She didn't think the Royal Navy would be quite so sanguine.
Can you ensure it doesn't happen again? I think a couple of command notes would need to be rewritten, Maddie said.
She bit her lip.
That's a task for a proper webhead, not me. It would be better, I think, to take the system offline while we're carrying out exercises.
Abigail nodded sourly. Maddie deserved one point, at least, for being smart enough to admit her limitations. Trying to reprogram a computer core was incredibly difficult. Abigail had never been comfortable with a system she couldn't control perfectly, let alone repair. There were too many horror stories about hacker anarchists, dating all the way back to the Age of Unrest. Hanging a few hundred of the bastards hadn't stopped others from trying to break into sealed computer networks. Abigail could lose control of her ship and never know it.
If we take the system offline,
Whitehead said,
how long will it take to get it back online? 5 minutes,
Maddie said.
Which would be too long if one of those sensor contacts happens to be real,
Whitehead said.
Are there no other options?
Maddie hesitated.
We can alter our programming to some extent,
she said.
If I fiddle a little, I can draw a line between exercises and reality. But realistically, I can't go too far without risking a total collapse.
I see, Abigail said. She scowled in disapproval. There had been too many vague sensor contacts since the convoy had left Earth, some of which had been close enough to force Commodore Banks to alter course. None of the contacts had opened fire, at least, but everyone was jumpy. There was no way to know if the contacts were alien starships or simple sensor glitches. Logic suggested the latter, yet no one knew.
Alan, she said, what do you think?
Alan started, as if he hadn't expected her to ask him anything.
"We cannot stop exercises," he said slowly. "I think we'll have to coordinate with the rest of the convoy, ensuring that we can take down our point defense network long enough to carry out the exercises in peace."
"We could simply tell the computers not to do it again," Savage pointed out.
"Yes, we can stop this problem from repeating itself," Alan said. "But what about the next problem? What will happen next?"
"We don't know," Abigail thought. "And if we knew, we could stop it."
She shrugged.
"We'll take down the network when we start the next set of exercises," she said.
It was a risk, but she saw no alternative.
"Alan, make sure that Commodore Banks knows what we intend to do."
"Aye, Captain."
"Good,"
Abigail said.
"And now we have that matter under control?"
She ignored Whitehead's snort with the ease of long practice.
"What do the exercises tell us?"
"That we have a great deal of work to do," Alan said. "We lost the carrier. Twice."
"Ouch,"
Abigail said. She listened to the discussion that followed, noting where the Navy and the Belt seemed to agree and where they differed. Some of their points were good ones. The quest for glory versus the need to actually win the engagement. And others seemed flawed. She couldn't help thinking that Navy pilots were far too much like overgrown children, rather than responsible.